Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Deepest Lore. Sorry, we're a bit late. We're getting to the age now, Simon.
Mm.
When it's like, oh, do you remember that show? What was it called again?
Yes.
And we were trying to remember Nora Batty from Last of the Summer Wine.
That's right.
But got her confused with Mavis from Corrie or something like that, didn't we?
Ina Sharples or something.
Ina Sharples.
Yeah, that's right. We were just waiting. Sorry, folks, we're late. We were waiting. Horace was out the back in the yard, wringing out his Pearly King outfit in the mangle, while the kids, the Cockney chirpy kids, run barefoot in the street out the back. We've got this vision of Horace lives sometime in the sort of, late 1950s in the East End, you see.
And out the back is just, it's just wasteland. It's just bombed out. It's like the set of Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
Cobbled, though. But
yeah. I was watching Bed Knobs and Broomsticks the other day. We're trying to watch it with, I try to encourage AAA to watch the same films I used to watch. She was bored stiff after a half hour. But there's a plot point in Bed Knobs and Broomsticks that Professor Brown has managed to cadge himself a massive mansion to live in because there's an unexploded bomb outside. And he's like, oh, in a weird way, this unexploded bomb's my best friend because now I live like a king. I forgot how like World War II, like it's set in 1940, that film. And the children are vaccines. They're sent to live with Mrs. Price. Angela Lansbury, they're sent to live with her. And the young lad is such a stereotypical beano, cockney, likely lad, itching, kind of.
Yeah.
Like he's a little bit artful dodger. He's a little bit kind of.
Yeah.
You know, they loved the cheeky chappy in the 60s.
Thumbs in braces, high kicking his cockney way, have a banana.
Yeah, but I see there's a plot in the plot of the film. They try to escape from her because she's really dour. She doesn't have sausage. He wants sausages, right? And she only gives them nettle soup. So the older one of the three kids, who's this cockney kind of geezer, Beano type character, they spot her. The whole thing is that she's a witch, so they spot her on her broom. So when she gets back, he's like, "All right, I'm gonna blackmail her, right? And in exchange for not revealing to everybody that she's a witch on a broom, you know, how about some sausages once in a while?" And it's just, it's kind of like, I don't know, the characterization of the kids in that film is worth a little look.
Wheeler dealing little barra boys, yeah.
Yeah.
Lansbury was she's part of the same family. She's the granddaughter actually of George Lansbury, who was the Labour Party leader before Clement Attlee. So,
really? Oh, was she?
Yeah, and her dad was a commie. George Lansbury's son was a commie, Edgar Lansbury.
Angela Lansbury is one of those women. Hmm. I mean, I don't know if it's because I grew up watching her in Murder, She Wrote, right? But she's one of those women who always look middle-aged. I mean, she's really young in Bed Knobs and Broomsticks, but she looks about 50. Same age as when she died. Go on, Simon, sorry.
Is she a wood, or is she in that film?
Now?
Yeah, not now.
No, she's
not
dead now.
Yeah, she's not a wood now. Not that kind of wood.
We've been 100. She would have been 100.
I don't know. I think she's got the look where she permanently looks a little bit like an old woman.
Mm.
Even though she's young in that film, she looks middle-aged to me.
So, I was thinking there's something.
They shall not grow old who were born that are left grow old.
I talked over you.
Sorry,
you say.
Sorry. isn't it? What's that saying? They shall not grow old who were born looking pretty old already. Saying it applies to certain people, doesn't it? It's just, you know, some people are just born looking 40 odd.
I was just thinking it's a nice idea, the fact that, you know, those kids during the war, they got this kind of break and they went out into the country and they could live this kind of, you know, idyllic lifestyle, you know, sort of, you know, almost Famous Five, go on adventures and all of that stuff. And then they get to go back to the city, you know, when it's safe again and it's all being rebuilt. And then they move into the kind of, you know, the sort of post-war 60s and, you know, the boomers kind of. They get this kind of, you know, this kind of retreat from the urban, and they get this sort of balance in their lives. And then I was thinking, you know, you couldn't do it now, of course. You wouldn't want to turn out the kids in the cities into the countryside anymore to give them the benefit of living outside the cities, because they'd just ruin the countryside.
And there may be even be an ethnic component to it now.
I'm not saying anything.
The urban youth go to visit Miss Price. It's a lovely looking town. In fact, I called the missus in. I said, where's this town? It looks lovely. She said, it's a painting. I was like, yeah, but it's got to be a real place. I think it's in Cornwall. I think it's set in Cornwall. I could be wrong. But Pepperingi is the name of the town.
When I was in school, Good Night, Mr. Tom was quite a famous book. I don't know if you guys know that one.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
I think they made a TV show with John Thor or someone, or David Jason, something like that. And yeah, it was about obviously a kindly man. You know, he seems very gruff and unwelcoming, but it turns out he really cares about the little boy and stuff. And the little boy is obviously terribly traumatized from being away from his parents. But if they you know, do a version of it now, it will be like, it'd be like an elderly Muslim woman going like evacuated, but playing a young boy or playing a young British boy or whatever. You know. And Mr. Tom will be, you know, I don't know, Mr. Singh.
Mr. Singh.
Mr. and Mrs. Singh. Yeah, something, you know, just whatever. They won the war for us.
I actually enjoyed watching the bit of the half hour of Bedknobs and Broomsticks again, though. It's like the second time I've tried to make AAA watch that film, but for some reason it doesn't grab her, kind of loses her attention. I'm trying to think of other women who permanently looked middle-aged. I mean, my mind went to Hillary, but then I remember, of course, Hillary had a moment where she was actually a bit of all right, wasn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
Helen Daniels in Neighbours was always old.
Who was, sorry?
Helen Daniels in Neighbours was always old.
Was she the doctor?
No, she was just Mrs. Daniels. She was just Helen Daniels. She was already retired at the age of like 20, you know, but looked 70.
Mrs. Daniels in Neighbours. What about Cilla Black? Cilla Black was young in the 60s, but to me, when I look at Cilla Black, she still looks... Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, she was always middle-aged. Helen Daniels. Yeah, what about Cilla Black? Even young Cilla Black looks old to me.
And Margaret Thatcher never really looked young and with it and, you know, nubile.
I think what it is, right, for us,
is
that the fashion of that period of the 40s and the 50s was the fashion of old people when we were young. So they look old, even though they're young, if that, like the clothes they wear and the hairstyles and so on. So it could be that. Looking at Cilla Black, to be fair, she does look quite young in the 60s.
Simon, some men, including Christopher Hitchens, said they were sort of a bit besotted by Mrs. Thatcher. She had sex appeal. In her 50s, we're talking 60s, 56. She was 50. She was about 50 when she became prime minister.
Yeah.
And we're talking after that, all through the 80s, various
the
men.
Tory kink. So, Yeah. And there was all this all kind of caricatures of her in sort of leather bondage gear and the frisson of meeting her that, you know, Alan Clark famously described as a de fure contact when you met Mrs. Thatcher.
Spitting image always had her in the leather gloves and stuff as a kind of thug, didn't they? Bullying the other cabinet members.
I was born a few years into her being prime minister, and I just found her like the national headmistress. She was like this horrible presence, like absolutely horrible. Just any time you turn on TV or radio, there's a 50-50, her horrible voice is coming out just telling everyone what to do, you know. All I knew was that she just seemed like a headmistress for the whole country, and everyone had to do what she said.
I think the reason that those Tory men like her is either one, because of her masculine qualities and they are homosexuals, or two, because of exactly that, Horace, they want to be caned by her or something like this. We've talked about this so many times, almost, but it is genuinely weird thing about Tories.
I've heard Tories themselves saying that like they were almost all beaten and raised by governesses, and it does something strange that they feel like they can't argue back against a woman or something. So she was able to win every argument, even if she wasn't right, she would bowl them over in every possible argument because they didn't know how to argue back. They never were allowed to when they were kids.
Very interesting.
Didn't she famously drop her voice a couple of octaves as well?
Yeah, she had coaching, yeah.
To make her sound more masculine. Or to less high-pitched, trill, wasn't it? I guess. Yes.
So this week, do you fancy that we'll cover 10 minutes or more of the documentary?
Did we even get to... I mean, I don't remember getting to Mao meeting Nixon. Did we actually get to that?
I think we did roll over it and... you know, there wasn't terribly much to say about it. Mao was dying, and Nixon was coming off the gold standard, and the world was in a moment of flux, and that will sort of amplify in this week's episode.
Yeah. The world at the moment seems to be in flux, doesn't it?
I was interested when you were talking to Blamblas Britannica, actually, about the sort of, you know, the waxing and waning of the slop cycle. And funnily enough, he used exactly one of the same words that Curtis uses. He talks about it. The new cycle comes over you like waves in a fever.
Yes.
And you were comparing. Interesting. You were comparing certain of the kind of these characters, shall we say, who shall remain nameless for the moment, who are sort of the arch conductors of all this online hysteria. You compared them to, you says, like the inflatable guys you see at the petrol stations.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
This is something that actually came up when we did hypernormalization. I forgot to mention it when we did the show. They're called air dancers.
Right, okay.
Air dancers. It's a bit like the wish casting phrase that you got in your from your Iranian guy yesterday. Air dancers. And Curtis was using them as this kind of recurring visual motif about sort of being blown along by the hot air artificially pumped into the narrative systems. And... if you remember, he filmed them in that strange, remarkable town, Wenatchee. And it's this place, when I thought about what you were saying, it sort of resonated with a lot of that stuff, because it's this remarkable microcosm of manufactured American dysfunction, where simultaneously you've got all these riving contrasts. You've got BlackRock has its big data servers there. So you've got immense power and rational control to anticipate the markets. And yet, the town was also noticeable. It was also notable, I should say, they had a Salem type hysteria over child abuse allegations, which later turned out to be false. It was this cop called Robert Perez and his foster daughter. She was about 13, and she started telling him that she'd been sexually abused in Wenatchee. And so he got so cross, he got her in the car and drove her around and got her to point out the houses where she'd been sexually abused. And she pointed out about 20 houses. And he went on this mad, zealous investigation. And all these people ended up, he ruined people's lives. He accused them of these false sexual abuse allegations. Even the local pastor, there were 11 counts of sexual abuse against him and his wife, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing about this cop, this Robert Perez guy, they know that he was the kind of person who could thrive in that atmosphere, close to power and hysteria. And they said in his performance evaluation, he likes confrontation and he likes having power over people. Mm. And I thought, it's exactly the kind of people we're talking about, whipping up the sort of the online animus and, jingoism and tub thumping at the moment. And the other thing about Wenatchee, of course, was it was one of the first places where they used SSRIs as a form of mass passivation of people. So it sort of encompasses the whole of the system at the moment, the sort of power, the whipping up of hysteria and giving you the sort of palliative and the strange deranged personalities who put themselves at the center of it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a video coming out soon about what smartphones are doing to our brains. I'm increasingly thinking of just, you know, my phone is broken, and I'm thinking of just not have it, like, doing away with it. And just by virtue of not having a phone, I'll probably spend less time on X, right? Because it's such a, you know, I mean, I will say my timeline, about a week or so ago, I blocked about 400 people, right, very purposefully, and I've just got it on following. So my timeline is much improved just by doing that, because I think they've changed it now that when you block people, you can't see their posts or they don't come up. So, yeah, I mean, it's still been pretty hysterical with the Iran news and Venezuela and the ICE thing. And, you know, it's all like hyper at the moment, and lots of people are arguing and so on. But I feel like, Simon, I feel like I've done my time in the trenches, and I just don't want to do it anymore.
I think that's it. Abandon Twitter. All ye who enter Twitter, abandon hope.
Do you know, Simon, one thing you said there a second ago just reminded me of... Well, yeah, I mean, we see it on Twitter now, but did you guys ever used to watch Bill Hicks, the comedian?
Oh, yeah. I used to be a big Bill Hicks fan.
Yeah, like, one of his famous sets, he just does a little bit about... Because, you know, he's sort of blending serious stuff with comedy all the time. Like, it's a more serious bit. He's talking about, like, war hawks, but he doesn't really specify whether he's talking about journalists or, I don't know. He's just doing someone's voice, and he just, at one point, he just goes, come on, let's get behind this thing now. Let's go. And he's just talking about the way that you're just hurried in an animalistic way into just running along with the herd. Like, it's just stop thinking. Stop thinking, guys. Just get behind this thing. Right? We've got a project here. Let's go.
Yeah, it's another form of inevitabilism, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so many things work like that. The thought is just cut out. I mean, it never enters the picture. And obviously, these guys, like, we're an obstacle for these people, but we're probably
the spot one. Yeah. Talk TV this morning are still, we're all for bombing the mullahs.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a lot of consent manufacturing on that front. Because my phone's not working, I'm stuck on LBC again. It's wall to wall consent manufacturing at the minute. One of the things I'm trying to find, Simon, to come back to what we were talking about just now, is did you see that visualization of the news cycles of last year? It was like around the time of the new year.
Yes,
and it was, it did look like waves. It did actually look like,
yeah,
because you can actually see the exact time where a new cycle peaks and then falls away. I wonder if our Egyptian activist El Fati will make it in the 2026 end of year review, or will it just be dominated by all the other stories that came along?
You do wonder if somebody could go in and really sort of blow the lid on a kind of, you know, wag the dog operation, and, you know, you find a completely a world that's parallel to Hollywood, where there are like writers' rooms and they're sitting around, like, they're plotting arcs of events. And doing the setups for these things, and then the kind of, you know, I mean, again, there must be an aspect of wrestling in the way that storylines are managed, the way they come in and drift out, and then you've got like stand-up comedy, you've got callbacks, and ways to make it resonate, but finding exit strategies from it as well. It must be really interesting to speculate on that.
What they do in pro wrestling storyline telling is that they'd have the year, right? They'd have the year blocked, like, the 12 months of the year, January, February, March, all the way up to December, plotted out. And usually it's punctuated by season-ending events. So, like, your classic, you know, WrestleMania, a season-ending event, a storyline will either start at WrestleMania or it will end at WrestleMania, okay? So you can have the year leading up to WrestleMania plotted out, certain things need to happen at certain times to build up to the big match, right? So if you take something like Hulk Hogan versus Randy Savage at WrestleMania 5, the entire year from WrestleMania 4 to WrestleMania 5 was already marked out, because they had Hogan help Savage at WrestleMania 4. They formed a tag team. They feuded with Ted DiBiase and Andre the Giant. Then there was simmering tension over the fall period and the winter. You know, eventually Savage couldn't take it anymore. exploded, the mega powers explode, there's WrestleMania 5. And in fact, then there's also a year from WrestleMania 5 to WrestleMania 6 for Hogan versus Ultimate Warrior. Because I think Ultimate Warrior won the IC belt, you know, sometime around there. He beat the Honky Tonk Man. And like, he was building, and then something happens for that to be. So they did block it all out. Now, some of the details, some of the angles and so on, may be worked out later on, but they kind of know where we're headed. Mm. And I believe, Simon, with things like, let's say, a possible military strike on Iran, these things do seem like they're plotted out on a timeline, because certain things need to happen, right? For example, people in the West need to have it in their minds that the mullahs are a bad regime who need to kill protesters and are authoritarian and need to be brought down, as an example, as a pretext to do something else, right? But we know that this idea of a conflict with Iran has been bubbling away ever since the 12-day war. That was, what, 6 months ago? Mm. So there must be somebody who does this function.
Mm.
So, I don't think every single story is mapped out like that, but certain really key ones that are important to the security state, I think, are very tightly man-managed.
Yeah, we're not talking about a sort of conspiratorial sense of everything being hyper-planned. Obviously, certain things happen in contradiction or at random or at variance with certain narrative threads. But I think there are certain narrative threads that are kept going and then revived. It's like this thing about digital ID. I mean, yes, everybody's excited yesterday about it going away, but nobody, I think, really believes it's going to go away.
Yeah, maybe a bit of hopium for us or something like this, for a temporary moment.
Bit of light relief. Who do you think in a wrestling match, if it was Starmer Blair, I mean, Blair would have to win, wouldn't he? I mean, would Starmer get any breaks where he would dominate over Blair in the ring?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of difficult because in British politics terms, Blair would be the equivalent of a legend or an icon coming back, right? So he'd always be coming back into the arena as someone who was formerly a big main eventer, whereas Keir Starmer is just a currently very unpopular champion who the crowd doesn't like. Not just in kayfabe, they literally just don't like him. They want him to go away, you know? So, yeah, I think in those sorts of circumstances, I think Blair would go over in those, But, I can't find that visualization. It was very good, but I can't seem to find it. Because it's also interesting then to look back on which stories actually made a big enough bubble to make it onto the end of year. And there were probably lots and lots of things that everybody gets, caught up in for a day or so that's then never mentioned again as well. You forget all of those little stories, the mini cycles. And what, this is something that Joseph Jordan has noticed, that Trump, when he's gearing up for a massive betrayal of his base, always chucks a bit of slop, hopium, or something to get the base riled up, a domestic story, right? So when there's a foreign policy betrayal coming, usually there's some sort of prep on the domestic front to get people back on side, right? And you could say, well, if there's an Iran strike coming, we've had this, I mean, I don't know if it's not planned or deliberate, but it's the most recent example. The ICE thing has brought, like, Trump was losing people, over the past few months. The ICE thing seems to have been just enough to get people back for a while. While they're back, let's do the Iran strike or something like this. And this is just a pattern he's noticed over the past however many years that Trump always does this. So whether Trump plans that or not, or does it instinctually, I don't know. But it is a pattern. He usually does the most base-seeming thing just before he's about to lay in the blade, as it were. And it seems like we're gearing up for that right now.
What was the red meat on this occasion? What are they throwing at us here?
I think it's the way the Treads have reacted to the ICE thing, and the way that the administration have covered for the ICE officer. This sells the dream for us of based Stephen Miller, who's secretly a fascist or something.
Oh yeah, I see.
Well, I mean, to us it looks ridiculous, but for those people trapped in it, they can't see it, and you can see that just, down your timeline.
Assume even on that tiny level, it's just rhetoric anyway. They will betray that ICE agent later if they need to. Just forget about what he's ransacked, like that Derek Chauvin. I know it's a bit different, but it'll just be thrown to the wolves if necessary, right? But later,
yeah. I mean, I don't. To be honest, on this occasion, there's been a lot of what's the opposite of red meat, blue meat, empty plates, empty bowls. I mean, Trump has just recently denounced anti-Semitism, said that anti-Semites aren't welcome in MAGA, which, if you've been following that storyline, seems to be a rebuke not only of Nick Fuentes, but of Tucker, right? That's the narrative that the Mark Levins and the Ben Shapiro wanted. And they saw that proclamation by Trump as being a massive victory for Team Zaya, because he said the thing. Anti-Semites aren't welcome in the Republican Party. What does that mean in the current context? It means Nick Fuentes. It means Tucker. It means Candace Owens. And depending on how far you take it, Steve Bannon and all the other people.
I've really enjoyed seeing that big split in stuff like Turning Point and, the MAGA movement and stuff, because, it is just, it's not one movement. So let's just drop the pretense, right? It's Israel first versus America first, at the very least, maybe other complications. So it's good to see it splitting, but I do feel like the sort of the Tucker and people on his side, they're not really organized and they're not really going to do much about, they've achieved some things in terms of causing some rancor and discord, but they're not organized. They won't capitalize on it. Whereas Trump, the bench is,
sorry. So I was just going to say, it's just Trump ejecting his radicals, isn't it?
Right. Say. Like, basically, they will get forced out, or sidelined in some way, or TPUSA will cease to matter if they take it over. Then it will cease to be heard by Trump and so on.
What's kind of disappointing to me, though, is that it feels like, I mean, again, it's hard to say because I'm not in America. I only see the Twitter timeline. It seems like those obvious conclusions that you're drawing there, Horace, are then forgotten in the middle of a news cycle. So this thing with the ICE woman, to me, seems to have brought a lot of people who were seeing things as they were back on the reservation again.
As if
because they feel they need to, defend the notion of deporting people or defend ICE or something like this. And now Trump has somehow got them back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Sad that it's so easy. But like most people want to crawl back towards, I mean, I don't know how many, but like it seems like the great mass of people want, even if they know it's false, they just want to be convinced or convince themselves of a way to crawl back into the safe zone, the center of it. And they will, if they can, even including Tucker, including most of these renegades. Candace Owens has got, I don't know. She's very rich now, isn't she? So is Tucker. But I don't see these people as leaders at all or inspiring at all. They've done a good thing a couple of months ago, but that's it.
Yeah, Tucker has. I mean, for his Tucker has remained anti-neocon on a lot of things, which not all of those people have, on Venezuela, on Iran, and so on and so forth.
That's good.
So Tucker's been pretty consistent there. But again, you see, that's another thing, is that for me, if it becomes obvious that the empire is not being ruled for you, but for another people, I still just don't get my head around the mindset that says, yeah, but let's fucking take Greenland. But it's like, for who? I don't get that. But apparently, this is some weird switch that triggers in Americans' heads, and it's like, well, yeah, they're on board with that now. I don't get it personally.
That was my outrage with the Maduro, Cesar Maduro. Like, I hate Maduro. I really do agree that he it is his fault, like, and Chavez's fault and their movement. I do blame them for the state of Venezuela, but it's not the point. It's like, do we suddenly believe? Is Mark Levin suddenly out of the picture? Is Miriam Adelson suddenly not there? Like, did Trump suddenly become good for 10 minutes and then not? Like, what? How would that happen? Of course, it's the same Trump. It's the same Trump who does everything for Israel and nothing for his own people. So he's obviously not doing it for us.
And he's increasingly palling about with Lindsey Graham, who is just having the time of his life. We talked about the little, what do you call that little dancing man on the top of the wave?
The air dancer, yeah.
Lindsey Graham is having the air dance of his life right now, isn't he?
That little rant of him, yeah, was astonishing.
He's just so excited.
Horrible, horrible individual.
There's nothing worse than the war party and warmongers. They're the worst people of all. They're worse than child abusers, worse than everything. They're the worst scum, the lowest scum in the world. I hate them.
So, anyway, let us get back then to Can't Get You Out of My Head. I should probably, as I'm finding it, I'll probably play the ad, promo code Shorjan. Be sure to check out Horace's Substack. Follow Simon on Twitter. Do you have anything else other than the Twitter, Simon?
Nothing at the present time, but I'm encouraging people to go and look at Nathan Hood's project, the Pendragon Foundation, which is going to be looking at restoring and reviving castles as living features of our landscape and our communities. And he will be at some point needing volunteers to help on projects. So do go and look in on that. There's pendragon.foundation online, and there is the Pendragon Foundation account on Twitter, which you can find by searching easily.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure,
sure, sure, sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure,
sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, 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 sure.
Yeah, I mean, one small story that happened on the Trump front before we get to this. Did you see he went to that Ford factory and the worker there Ford factory called him a paedophile protector, and he stuck the middle finger up at him and said, F you.
Conduct unbecoming.
That is a bad look for a president, surely. I mean, for the guy who came in to make America great again, manufacturing, being seen to bully a factory worker on Epstein files is just, I don't know. I mean, I just don't understand how anybody can still have any time for him at all.
Personally. It's just the loss of propriety that's everywhere, especially on social media, this thing of especially politicians or public figures relaxing their decorum, let's say, and addressing people, even who are hostile commentators or the public, with any kind of abuse or coarseness. I think, as you say, it's just a bad look all around. But we've entered an age where, I mean, I don't understand why even MPs or people like that make personal responses on Twitter and insult members of the public. Because, irrespective, I think, as you were saying in one of the streams recently, you know, you've got to represent all the people, even the ones you don't like. That's what you've got to get your head around in this notion of democracy.
But you see, even in that conversation, right, that I was having with Todd Lewis, I think that was one of the ones I put the premiere on, let the live chat run during it. I don't always do that. But I happened to see that as I was saying that, you know, this woman who was shot by the ICE officer, you know, she was a mother of three. All right, she was an activist, left wing, whatever. You know, it's still like your common humanity, your common humanity. There was a guy in the chat saying, oh, AA sounds like a bleeding heart liberal. I'm like, oh, I mean, hold on a second now, right? Your whole deal is that you're a Christian. Your whole gimmick, to in pro wrestling terms, is that you're a Christian. Surely this is like the most basic little bit of Christian morality imaginable. Just don't celebrate the murder of somebody. You can defend the ICE officer. You can say she was there in the wrong or whatever.
Yeah.
But so like meme and celebrate it. Yeah. To me, it just seems like, I mean, unbecoming is understating it, Simon.
I've given up trying to explain it because it seems to be far too nuanced for most people to get, but it seems really basic and obvious to me when you're trying to explain something about just, you know, as people have said, it's poison for the soul. You know, it hurts your own dignity and your own sense of proportion. It's not that, you know, people think you're justifying against what has been done. You know, that, well, we should be glad that these people are dead. And, you know, I said to somebody on Twitter, I said, I've known people who've been soldiers at the very highest level in the special forces. People have been firearms police, and they've definitely killed people. And they don't jump up and down on the bodies after they do it. No. In fact, most professional people in the business of violence like that really regret it. It really chews them up later on. Yeah. But at the time, they certainly don't have this weird, as you say, sadistic enjoyment. But I've given up trying to explain
that to people. Unless they're IDF, of course, because they've engaged in that sort of horrible behavior too.
Mm.
But, you know, like we've come to a point now where the likes of me and Morgoth and a few other people, but Simon, we're being called gentle Gen Xers. Oh, come on now. I mean, it's just a gentle Gen Xer, you know. It's not being gentle, or, you know, it's not, you know, saying what needs to be done doesn't, you know, needs to be done and so on.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of like, how can I put it? I mean, I said it like with the bombing of the tomb of Chavez. You may dislike Chavez or whatever, and apparently it didn't happen, okay? But I don't get the sadism, Simon.
No,
Seems wrong. It just seems like sick for the soul, as you said.
Yeah, and it becomes a kind of... The terrible thing, the invidious thing about it is it becomes an old versus young thing. You know, I'm a bit older than a lot of the people commentating on stuff, and you're always in that terrible position that you remember as a young man when an older man would say to you, I don't think that's a good idea. And you would come back with a kind of, why, what's wrong with you? Are you weak? Can't you get it up, old man? You know, what's wrong? You know, you're not hardcore enough anymore. And it's not that. If anything, I'm more hardcore about things than when I was younger, but that I do have certain lines because, you know, after so many years of seeing, you know, the soul chewed away, you value it, and you want to sort of keep a line between certain things and not. You know, people say, oh, you know, you just want to feel like you're better than other people. It's not that at all. It's not some sort of false sense of moral superiority. It's just that it's corrosive when you go to that place, because it feeds on itself. It vomits its own vileness up, and it feeds off it, and then you just end up in a sort of disgusting world. But, like I said,
just to go back to pro wrestling, like I said before, anybody in any walk of life understands that sort of behavior is villainous. It's heel.
Mm.
It's bad. And there's a reason that it's seen as like not something to do. Right? You don't like, you know, and I don't know, to me, it just feels like, especially when these guys are I'm not even a Christian. And I'm like, well, okay, but this is, you know, people call me nihilist and amoral and all that sort of stuff. But that's just not the case. I mean, I can still recognize what's right and what's wrong.
It feels like a basic moral position.
Just so basic. But anyway, we're in a crazy moment.
In conclusion, you don't sound like a bleeding heart liberal. You sound like a bleeding heart sensible centre leftist. So everything's all right.
Anyway, let's carry on here. I mean, even when we've been watching Adam Curtis and we've been seeing these brutal regimes and, you know, figures from the past and so on, it's always obvious to me when it tips over into something that shouldn't be happening. Now, do you remember when we were watching the Egyptian stuff, Simon? We said then, it was like, oh, okay, you've gone over into a point where clearly what you're doing is evil at this point.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not going to produce... This is... Anyway, anyway, let's not digress. Nixon went to China and went to see an opera with Mrs. Mao, who's still knocking about. Yeah.
That's it, wrong.
Nixon, sitting next to her, had now become obsessed with plotting to destroy his imaginary enemies. He had set up a conspiracy based in the White House. It was run by a group of ex-intelligence agents, and they were already planning to bug, burgle, and blackmail Nixon's opponents. Behind his smile, he was preoccupied with plotting and scheming. Jiang Qing and Richard Nixon were two of the most powerful people in the world at that moment. But what they shared was a sense that power was now slipping from their grasp. While the new force that Nixon had unleashed, money, was eating away at the idea that there was a fixed, predictable system that any politician could control. Because the bankers had realized that currencies could be traded globally, like any other asset. And what that had created was a fluid, constantly changing reality that no one was fully in control of.
3542 then.
Hello, 3542.
It dropped 100 points. We don't know why. It just dropped 100 points when everything else was staying 30.
All right, 30 other way.
30 other way.
Change
Stop it.
Change.
Sorry to pause it already. Do you know what must be gutting for newsmakers now whenever there's a financial, you know, crisis or, you know, dip in the stock market or something? They don't have that, like, there's not the footage of the guys on the phones anymore. It's all like algos and computers and so on. Like, there's nothing exciting you can show. So they end up like showing a graph or something like that. It's not as not as fun, is it?
I wish someone would do a video essay or explainer, because I, you remember all that sort of footage we saw before in things like the Mayfair set of the stock exchange floor, and they've got the guys in the multicolored jackets, and you've got the hand signals and all of that kind of stuff. I wish someone would do an explainer on all of that kind of now lost culture. That's really interesting to me, and I don't understand anything about it at all.
Well, Simon, you have the buy side and you have the sell side.
Right.
The buy side are people who are investing money by it, actually doing the buying and the selling. And the sell side are the people working on the behalf of often the investment bank, but sometimes other brokers as well, who are executing those trades in exchange for a fee. So if you can imagine, the buy side is where all the money is, where all the money, all the actual trading is going on. Okay. This is your asset management firm. And the sell side are literally just people who are employed to do that stuff, because you're not allowed, like, you can't just buy and sell without that middleman being there. It's got a special license, a special seat, they call it. And so the sell side people make their money with what I think they call it pips, but it's basically just a fee, an execution fee, just like when you buy something on your credit card. There's a fee to Visa for executing the trade, right? In exactly the same way, the sell side person there is simply just executing the trade on behalf of the client, whoever it is, as an asset management firm. And I do have a video on this in the archive somewhere called All About Investment Banks. So if you watch that, you'll understand who those men are. Some of them are giving the order. Some of them are like on the asset side, giving the order for what they want to do. But a lot of the people that you'll see there will be on the sell side, simply doing the executions. You know, they've had the order from their client, what they want to do, and they're simply working on their behalf. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm just fascinated by the apparent chaos when you see the footage of dozens of these guys all standing around yelling, and hands are going up and fingers are being twiggled around and you know, quotes are being shouted across the room. At whom, I wonder? And how is the information being acted upon? Because they all seem to be just scribbling on notepads or something.
The reason for the panic, of course, is because time is of the essence. You know, the difference between now and now could be a couple of thousand pounds, or you know, these days it might be millions of dollars. That's why a lot of it has become, I mean, as you can imagine, done through wire, right, through computers. So you don't actually have a physical guy there on the phone anymore, because you know it'd be too costly to wait. So it's become a lot faster these days.
Seeing those floors with everyone shouting like that and trying to, you know, match a buyer to a sell order, that's a particular stock exchange. So that, I mean, in movies and documentaries, usually London or Wall Street, or I think in trading places it's Chicago at the end. But
yeah, Chicago,
yeah, that's the scene at a particular stock exchange on the trading floor.
But So I mean, Chicago is a good example. Like, Chicago traditionally was a commodities, like the stock exchange for commodities, metals, things like
still is.
Commodities, right? And so let's say the investor wants to, I don't know, let's just pretend that they want to get rid of their stock in oil, let's say, and they want to get into precious metals, okay? They'll put that through to the sell side guy on the floor who's executing it for them, because they're not allowed in there, you see. They're special seats within, they call it seats, even though they're standing up. There's a special spot in there. You can't let any old Tom, Dick and Harry in there, right? It's a special license that the investment banks and various other brokers have to stand on that floor, right? So
the stock exchange.
They're in the stock exchange, but the guys actually in the stock exchange are working for various different investment banks. It could be Barclays Capital or JP Morgan or somebody like this. And they then will be working on behalf of some, like they could be working for BlackRock, say. They could be working for whoever who is, you know, they're their customer. And they'll take, like, I don't know.
The guy at the stock exchange is acting as an advisory broker for them.
Exactly. He's an advisory broker who's there to execute the trade. And he's got some idea, oh, this guy wants to get out of oil, he wants to get into this. I have to do that for him. And if he misses it, he's not going to get his fee. And then he's going to get in trouble with his boss or whatever. You fuck this up, mate. You know, so that's why there's so much panic and so on, and that's what's happening on that floor. Anyway, let's carry on.
Все на белом свете, люди издавна повторяются, было, есть и снова будет так. Но для всех влюблённых песня заново начинается. Было, есть и снова будет так. Будет так, будет так, будет так, будет так.
Было, есть и снова будет так. У любви свои законы, сердце разума не послушает.
Было, есть и снова будет так.
Do you think they gave Lennon and McCartney royalties for this?
No. They... No, I don't think they sued for copyright. They completely rewrote the lyrics. As I said last week, it's more or less the theme of the song is basically saying everything remains the same. The song is actually titled, interestingly, to what we were talking about, waves of news. It's titled "Obletele bezonaya novost." Crazy news has spread that everything is just going to stay the same. As I said, these people were actually dissidents. This was a kind of satirical sketch. Vaktan Kikabidze there, called Buba, who was a sort of Georgian nationalist and a parliamentarian, and Lyudmila Gutchenko. She was married six times, so she was very much a wood for a lot of guys. And this was something from 1976 called A Magic Lantern, where they did this satirical kind of slightly over-the-top sketch You know, they're signaling heavily that you're not meant to really take it seriously. But it is, they were both kind of people. She was sort of effectively cancelled in her career, came back very late on around this time. She was actually quite big in the 50s. And then the regime kind of brought her back. She was thought to be kind of too modern and a bit racy. And eventually they were both allowed to sort of do this.
She's another one, look, with a touch of the Angela Lansbury. She could be anything from 28 to 60.
Mm.
Can't tell.
And so what? So her... Yeah, she's any age between 30 and 60. But it was... So apparently her first husband, she divorced... And the second one was beheaded, is that right? The third one died.
One.
And then the fourth is another divorce.
Yeah.
Second one.
I don't know the details. Yeah.
The last one outlived her.
Wow. There you go.
No, I'm joking. No, I mean, like.
Exactly. It was very obscure. It's very difficult to find much information on this particular video. It's not really known much else about the rest of the show, where it came from, the rest of the context. But. You'll see when he kind of rolls his eyes at the end of the song, it's obviously meant to be flagging that we're not being serious.
So are they mocking sort of revolutionary conservatism coming from the regime that, like, everything's fine now, we don't want things to change?
In a sense, it's kind of it's a sort of response to the sense of hypernormalization in the late Soviet Union, right. Yeah. You know, right. It's how it's always going to be, and it's perfect. You know, we're reinforcing all of the propagandistic norms of the regime. You know, everything's great, and it's really kind of all how it was always meant to be, really.
Tragic.
The idea of her being divorced four times for some reason puts me in mind of Tales of the Unexpected, because those characters were always getting, you know, they were always like killing their husbands by like slipping on a rug or killing him with a frozen leg of lamb or whatever it is. And often it was to, you know, for the house or some, it was obviously something in Roald Dahl's imagination. And funny enough, I don't know if you're on the same algorithm as me, Simon, because you sent me a video the other day. That came up on my timeline as well.
The BBC archive of Will Self discussing Mortal Kombat when it came out.
Exactly that video came up on my timeline as a kind of, oh, we think you're like that. And I was like, oh, yeah, I did actually.
Me as well. I got that one as well.
Another one came up was unintentional ASMR, right? Unintentional ASMR of people meeting Roald Dahl, like somebody going to visit Roald Dahl. I thought, tell you what, if I could live in this video, that would be a place like to get away from it all. I would love to see if I could get that up, because it was I'll download it and show it to you in a minute. All right, let's carry on.
Даже в худшие минуты людям верится только в лучшее. Было, есть и снова будет так.
Here it is, Simon, right? If you want positive vision, let's try to get here. Okay, let's try to get here.
The man who lives in this house makes very good orange marmalade. He also breeds orchids. He has never eaten a dish of tripe in his life, and he wishes that his dog could speak to him. And that eccentric sequence of autobiographical irrelevancies may even give you a clue as to who he is. He's Roald Dahl, of Norwegian and Welsh origins, and by now probably the most widely read author of children's books in the entire world. Titles like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach, Danny the Champion of the World, and most recently, the BFG, the Big Friendly Giant. They're the sort of books that have brought him such a worldwide readership that he's reputed to spend £200 a month on postage alone, just answering the letters from his young readers.
We didn't even need to see Roald Dahl. Yeah. That's enough. I want to go there.
Cozyville.
What's this guy's accent?
I don't know.
He could be slightly Irish, actually. He sounds a little bit like Anthony Clare.
Where he said world, he said it like in an Irish way, right? But he also sounded a little bit Welsh at one point.
Yeah, and it's a very strange accent. There is a bit of Welsh in there.
Yeah, he sounds like he's someone who's settled in England, and obviously, you know, he's got sort of BBC type diction. But there's a slight twist in the accent. I remember Anthony Clare, the psychiatrist, was from Ireland, but he had a sort of similar voice.
Well, when I was watching this, I called the missus in and I said, just watch the start of this. Who do you think he's talking about? She got it in one. She said, oh, is it Roald Dahl? I was pretty impressed by that. Would you get it from this?
Yeah. In this house, makes very good orange marmalade. He also breeds orchids.
So I'd have thought the marmalade would throw you off and think he was talking
and
about...
And he's a notorious anti-Semite.
Didn't he work for, like, MI6 as well?
I think they all... Any intellectual of that period or writer ended up working for the intelligence, like Orwell and... anyway, and we see him. I didn't actually get up to him. There he is. Look. Okay.
Do you know, in the documentary, do we come to the gold window thing again, or are we past that? The Nixon...
They will mention it, and they'll say something about, you know, what Nixon had accidentally done. And I know people have taken issue with that statement, so that will come back later, yeah.
Okay. Edward Limonov had now left Ukraine and come to Moscow. He became part of what was called the Underground. Writers and painters who saw themselves as the opponents of the regime. Limonov became a poet. And one night at a party, he met a girl who he fell passionately in love with. She was called Yelena Shapova. And together, they became a glamorous couple in the underground world.
Now that looks like the front cover on an album or something, to be fair, doesn't it?
Yeah, there is a film about Limonov called Limonov the Ballad with Ben Whishaw. It was put out a few years ago. It's a bit unevenly written as a film, and it tracks Limonov going from the sort of the bohemian set where he wants to be a poet in the Soviet Union to New York, where he eventually just lives a completely degraded lifestyle, where he ends up working as a waiter and being bummed by black men.
Oh, God's sake.
There's a lot of gratuitous sex with the actress playing Elena in the first part of it, so it may be worth watching for that.
She's a bit all right, isn't she?
Did that happen to the real guy?
It seems. Yeah, he wrote this book, It's Me, Eddie, where it was a kind of thinly disguised version of his life in New York. But yeah, I mean, he sort of, as Chris Morris says, anything with a spinal cord, he would do it, you know. And he was pretty exploratory, but this is why he's sort of aligned with this sort of sense of emerging punk sensibility, that he was out for the truth and he didn't care who knew it.
I just, as soon as you mentioned Ben Whishaw, somehow I knew it would be, there'd be some gay element to it. Like, I don't know why.
Nice. Funny that.
Like, Ben Whishaw's not even like camp or anything, but it's just like, it's just always, I don't know. I know he is gay, but for me.
Well, I think it's part of the duty to write into a film now anything that, you know, gives a kind of ambiguous sexuality.
And
to
gay actors
anyway.
Really mediocre gay actors as well.
Well, yeah. he plays Richard II in the Holocaust. And there's a long history of playing Richard II as quite an effete character. Mm-hmm. But in that production, he's all in white and he's got like a little pet monkey, which is a strange. Kind of strange.
Well, he plays Richard II.
He plays Richard II in a particularly... I mean, Richard II is always camp for some reason. There's a long... I remember watching a paper from a Shakespeare scholar once explaining how that tradition of playing Richard II as an effete, kind of probably gay character came about. Mm. And it was invented at some point. And he was arguing that Shakespeare's audience would not have... I don't know if I'm convinced by this argument. He was arguing that they would not have seen Richard II as an effete character, and that was not Shakespeare's intention, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, though, because a Shakespeare
sounds
character
like the sort of thing,
go on.
That when there's certain monarchs who are hated, who make enemies of anyone, as Richard II did, that they often get written about as like really like girlish or effeminate and stuff. Like Heliogabalus, the Roman emperor, famously, but there's loads of other characters like that in history. Like where anyone who would write a praising history of them is just killed or excluded from the court or whatever.
Well, Richard II didn't have kids and had favourites at court, quote unquote, and loved
the
art.
How old was he when he was killed? He wasn't that old, was he?
Well, he started. Well, he was an infant king, but I believe the historical Richard II's wife was only 12 or something, so she probably wasn't old enough to have babies, you know. But yeah, there's a kind of it's ambiguous. But
I've watched plenty of Starkey, and Starkey likes to mention when people were gay, and he never says that about Richard II. He says it about all the others.
No, I think it's not suspected. It's the relationship he had with his court favourites that was, you know, deemed to be.
Is it Emile? Emile, I think, is the character.
Yeah, Emile, Bushy, Baggett, and Green, and. I'll say Fay in Effeminate is definitely not how I played him in 1992. I had big Dr. Martin boots on and a flash of dyed blonde hair, and I played him as witty and cruel and a tyrant.
Oh, so you played a butch Richard II?
Saying butch automatically frames it within the, the gay frame, then.
Lesbian subculture, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
We discussed it, me and my co-director, and we just decided on a rationale that he was actually trying to run the country well, but he was making all the mistakes of a kind of a young man, you know, trying to use violence and cruelty and finding that it sort of doesn't work and it turns everybody against you. And that's, we sort of emphasized that rather than the kind of, you know, fluid sort of sexuality, which a lot of people like to play.
So to come back to this, I want to come back to this Warren Zevon looking guy on the left here. So these two, were they having it off, or were they talking about bumming black men here?
No, they were sort of Limonov felt, as I say, passionately in love with her, even to the extent of trying to commit suicide at one point when she turned him away. And then they were sort of essentially exiled to America and became a kind of, you know, it couple. For a while, you know, being photographed in sort of society circles because people wanted to have, you know, pet Russians as a kind of, you know, exotic thing at their parties. Eventually she went off with, I think, an Italian count, and he became very depressed and then kind of bummed around in New York, eventually ended up working as a busboy at a very chic French restaurant. And then he worked as a butler for this banker guy or something, and lived in his apartment while he sort of rebuilt his career as a writer, writing this book, It's Me, Eddie, which I think was banned in the Soviet Union, but eventually he went back to the Soviet Union and they lifted the ban, and then he became a disruptor, kind of a form of Bolshevik nationalist, which, you know, Curtis will go into later.
It's something very, dare I say, Pinterest about becoming a butler in 1970s New York for some banking dude and then ending up indulging a gay lifestyle.
Yeah. It's a bit almost like a sort of Orwell Down and Out in London and Paris, but it's very spiky, the book. You know, he's very angry at America. He's angry at Russia as well for you know, reasons of its bureaucracy and its oppression. But America, he finds... It's a strange thing in a way that very much parallels, if you remember back to Power of Nightmares, when Said Qutb went to America in the 40s and he went to Greeley in Colorado, and he witnessed America in its kind of pomp and decadence, and he felt himself repulsed by it. And Limonov, very similar in a way, came to different forms of action after it, but they kind of rejected America's sort of sybaritic lifestyle and its sort of sense of moral vacuum, and Limonov was angry and he wanted to change the world, and the book is full of sort of excoriating passages about everything about Americans and their social life, their sexual life, you know, their political apathy, etc., etc.
Sounds like it could have some base passages in there. Maybe I'll plunder it one day.
Could be interesting, yeah.
She is hot, though. Let's face it. She's smoking hot, this girl.
I feel he's battered above his weight there, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do we know what song this is? Is this an Aphex Twin piece? don't recognize it.
Don't know.
Ambient sort of track.
Looking at my notes, can't see at this present moment. I'll let you know if I remember it.
I'm not having a go here, but doesn't he look a little bit like my recent guest, Blamblas? Kind of like a, could be him.
With a haircut, yeah.
Yeah, just change. Yeah. He genuinely does look a little bit.
Like interesting that she's got a poodle there, by the way. I think Vladimir Putin famously has a poodle called Tosya, which is something that they kind of tend to play down. In Russia, because it's not kind of macho enough for his image, but you know, I think he likes them because he regards them as quite intelligent and pleasant dogs.
People are saying that, you know, we had the Adam Curtis bingo card. Mm. People are getting a Horace bingo card now. One of them is like going on a rant about monetary policy, but another one is saying, "Is that a fixed
Is that what?
Is that Aphex Twin?
Yeah, you're always picking
you ask it every single week.
No, yeah. I know most Aphex Twin. I actually bought like everything I could possibly find of Aphex Twin. I know most of his stuff. I know that track almost certainly wasn't Aphex Twin, although I was only that obsessive a fan up until a certain time, so I suppose there could be newer releases. But this, anyway, we've heard this piece before. It's been used in other Curtis.
Yeah.
I have got another spiel about monetary stuff when we come to it, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, what else were we on the Horace card? Adam Curtis is talking utter crap.
But what Limonov began to discover was that most of the dissidents did not have a clear idea of what alternative they wanted. They too were trapped by the Soviet ideology. The most famous dissident was Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He was secretly writing a novel that was going to expose the horror behind the communist facade. It was called The Gulag Archipelago.
Pause. Just a couple of points. I just want to raise those statues are just quite interesting. The first one was the Lenin monument that was in East Berlin. It was knocked down eventually following reunification. Great big thing made by a Russian sculptor for the 100th anniversary of Lenin's birth. One of these sort of great expressions of monumental Soviet, you know, realism kind of and heroism expressed in sculpture. And that lady in the background there with the sword aloft on this this statuary here, that's something you should go away and look at. That's the Mamayev Kurgan Memorial in Volgograd. And it's a great big hill. And the hill covers an unmarked grave for 34,500 Russian soldiers who were killed at Stalingrad. And the statue itself is nearly 300 foot high. It's quite phenomenal to look at.
Massive.
Amazing. And then there was the little shot of the guy with a machine gun. And that's a sub statue in the compound called Stand to the Death Soldier. Really interesting complex, the Mamayev Kurgan. So do have a look at that. I think the piece of music here is called Don't Bother, They're Here by Stars of the Lid, according to my notes.
Stars of the Lid, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been told that when you're coming off of hard hallucinogenic substances, it's nice to listen to Stars of the Lid. Apparently, that's where the name comes from, because things dance inside your eyelids. You know,
I feel duty bound by the comrades to point out at this time that a lot of what you know about great man of history, Comrade Stalin, is from a novel. Now, why is it whenever anything is brought up about Stalin, your evidence is a novel? And I'll just leave that little thought teaser there. You can check out my previous videos on the truth about Stalin when you get the chance.
In the future, all knowledge of Stalin will be from an Amanda Iannucci movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Did anybody, like, I know we're not the most football-loving audience here, but did anybody watch the Russia World Cup 8 years ago?
No.
Because some of the games were in Volgograd. I think they renamed it once or twice. They've renamed Volgograd to Stalingrad for a year to like commemorate the war. Anyway, it was Volgograd at the time. And they had some beautiful aerial shots of this statue. Like, it was stunning photography. Like, yeah, it's really cool.
The statue is called The Motherland Calls. It's a huge woman with a big breasts and a huge sword.
It's a stirring sight. It really looks like it fits the landscape and stuff.
Who made that statue, incidentally? Like, when was it commissioned?
I don't know. I haven't got that in my notes. It was unveiled in 1967. Essentially, it was meant to be like Mother Russia, summoning you know, the people to fight. But I don't know who did that one.
I wish our guys would make statues like that.
Yeah. Really, it's phenomenal. There's another striking...
In East Berlin, like obviously just Berlin now, there's a massive... Well, it's not anywhere near, it's not 300 foot, it's nothing like that, but it's a big statue of just what's supposed to be like a standard Soviet warrior stomping on a smashed up swastika. Has anyone seen this? I'm sure it's on the internet. But it's another one of those. It's like, it looks pretty cool. It's like, it's good design. You know, I don't really share the communist vision, unlike AA.
But it's fascinating. Yeah, they're so unapologetic and, you know, not violent strong. Is not right the word, but assertive.
I don't share the communist vision, Horace. What I'm saying is, I feel like even within the depths of communism, something great and heroic and worthy was uncovered, even despite itself. If that makes any sense. And this statue,
the communist
is a pretty good
regime
example.
Was able to draw upon the full resources, bodily and psychological, of the Soviet people, the Russian.
Yeah, and okay, we'll call it a Russian achievement if you want to take it away from communism or whatever. But for me, something was done there, something was achieved, and it was achieved under Stalin. Anyway, let's carry on.
No doubt about.
But in the novel, Solzhenitsyn also confronted the fact that faced by the failure of the revolutionary dream, it was now difficult to believe in anything. That maybe ideology itself was the problem. The evildoers in Shakespeare, he said, killed just a few dozen in their struggle for power. But then came the belief that you could find a theory that would create an ideal world. The agents of the Inquisition, he said, invoke Christianity. The great empires, like Britain, justified it by the idea of civilization. The Nazis did it by race. And the revolutionaries, both in France and in Russia, justified it by equality, brotherhood, and the happiness of future generations. But in every case, he said, thousands and often millions were killed. Solzhenitsyn's book contained a damning conclusion, which was going to be one of the foundations of the counter-ideology that dominates the world today. It said that the only way to escape from that horror was to stop trying to change the world, stop trying to reshape reality. Instead, the safest thing to do in the future was to believe in nothing.
Yeah, do you hear Solzhenitsyn killing Stalin's dream? And now look, people are godless and nihilistic. They don't have great statues anymore. Thanks, Solzhenitsyn. Yeah. Anyway.
Interestingly, there's a scene in the film where Limonov is having sex with his girlfriend Yelena, watching Solzhenitsyn giving, I think, that speech on television, and he doesn't like Solzhenitsyn in that scene.
Limonov scorned Solzhenitsyn. He saw him as part of an older generation, trapped by their literary elitism. Ever since his time in Ukraine, he had been fascinated by what he saw as the real outsiders, those who refused in any way to be a part of the Soviet system. Above all, the thousands of criminals who lived most of their lives in the Russian prisons. They were called the Vorvi Zakonye, thieves in law. They had their own codes and hierarchies that were expressed in the complex tattoos on their bodies. The tattoos also expressed their fundamental belief that in a society where ideology controlled the minds of everyone, the only way to step outside the system was through violent crime. A singer called Arkady Seveny.
This is not a mile, not a million miles away from the ideology of Andrew Tate, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a million miles away from Tateism. I mean, I don't know if Tate advocates like a violent crime, but certainly he's happy to be part of some sort of murky underworld.
Absolutely.
And boasts about, you know, being on a yacht and, you know, talking to a guy who's made billions of dollars, you know, ripping off some African tin pot republic for its gold, something like this. You know?
Yeah.
This is the sort of world he, like, that's the message. He wants to sell the only way out.
Yes.
Of the Matrix is that in the Tate vision.
I'm glad you picked up on this. Exactly correct. This is exactly what I was going to say. This thing, the Vovi Sacconi, is really interesting. Those pictures come out of a book that was, or a series of books, actually, that was done by a guy called Arkady Bronikov. And it was they're published by a company called Fuel. If you search for Fuel online, Fuel Design. And they're really, really interesting. And they explain the nature of all of the tattoos, which we could do if you want to roll back a little bit to the first pictures of the guys with the tattoos on. I can tell you a little bit about those pictures. But basically, that they had their origins in the Gulag in the sort of 20s and 30s, and they developed a code of conduct called ponyatia, which was a set of rituals and hierarchy and behaviors. And there were some strict kind of sort of points that you had to incorporate to be one of the Vovi Sacconi. They were kind of like the officer class of criminals. In a sense, they are a network of tens. They are an organized minority, and they have this very radical way of stepping outside the system, as Curtis is saying. So some of the points they had to observe essentially were refusing to cooperate with the government or with the prison officials. So they reject the enemy frame completely or at all times. They have to earn a living solely from criminal activities. So they believe in becoming anti-fragile in a similar way to the way Tate, you know, vaunts the fact that you need that wealth to step away from the system. They believed in having no ties to the state at all, including not even serving in the army. So they didn't believe in any kind of entryism to the system. And this goes to a point you've been talking about recently, AA. They believed in not officially marrying or having a family, which goes to your point about figures acting as energetic political agents in a system. And they had this dress code and a specific language called Fenya and the tattoo symbolism as well. And they would act as these kind of high-ranking figures in the criminal underworld. They would arbitrate disputes and they would coordinate activity without necessarily participating in themselves directly. So they, you know, they would stand off from, you know, a lot of the sort of the low-level type crime. They would actually be the organizers. They would be in the background. They would be at a distance. They'd manage a kind of welfare fund for people in there, in the society of Vovi Sacconi. And so in a way, their focus on welfare is very much like when you look at the British Army, the responsibility of the officers, one of the first responsibilities is the welfare of the men. You know, it's not just, you know, shouting orders. And they would have various sort of rituals to sort of, you know, initiate people, like the mafia, you know, when you become a made man, all that kind of stuff. But this guy, the tattoos here, this is quite interesting. So this guy, the text on his stomach apparently reads, "Man is wolf to man." And on his arms, he's got written, "Live in sin, die laughing." If you can see on the right side, just below his rib cage, just below his right, on his right side there, you've got a pirate with a knife between his teeth. And it's usually accompanied by an acronym, IRA, I-R-A. It's a female Russian name, which is written on the knife. But actually what it stands for is Idu Rezat Aktiv, which means I'm off to kill the activists. And activists in this context means prisoners who collaborate with the prison authorities. So these were these types of prisoners. This guy was what we called a otritsali. They were the prisoners who refused to submit to rules in the prison. If you move on to the next guy, if you just
also express their fundamental.
This guy here, the double-headed eagle, is a Russian state symbol going back to about the 15th century, used by Peter the Great. And after the fall of communism, this is what replaced the hammer and sickle as the coat of arms of the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, it's a symbol of power and rage against the USSR. And you've got the eyes on the chest. This is a signification that of, it says, I can see everything, or I'm watching you. Basically, these guys, you know, we're sort of like the overseer class in the criminal fraternity. And on his arm, under the skull, he's got the Latin phrase memento mori, you know, remember you will die. And in his elbows there, you can just see inside of his elbows, they're hinges. It's a kind of sort of little bit of surreal prison humor that they put there. The next one's quite interesting.
Can I just say, though, a lot of this stuff looks cool.
Yeah,
it's a little bit undercut by the Statue of Liberty being there. Why is that there?
Yeah. It's you see that makes sense in the next one. But basically, there's an element of them longing for a kind of freedom. And they see that in America, that at least America represents that. And especially, in a sense, an American idea. I mean, this is something you can understand. The American idea of the criminal standing outside of society, as in hip hop culture, you know.
Well, Scarface again.
Yeah.
America's just one fat pussy and a girl fucked.
Yeah. So the next guy, if you show him, it's more explicit.
In a society where ideology controlled the minds of everyone.
Here he comes up.
Yeah.
This picture here. So that figure he's got there, apparently that was a sort of character from a TV crime series in the Soviet Union. He's a brutal gang leader, and he ends up in jail. But in this context, what it's showing is he's got a machine gun with US written on it. So the idea is he's defending himself against the Soviet power and fighting back. And what you're seeing is the skyscrapers and the dollar bills. And that's representing the kind of the ideological opposite of the Soviet Union. And it's talking about a hatred of their government in the Soviet Union. And again, the eyes are there. I'm watching you, you know. There's an epaulette on the shoulder, if you can see in the top left corner. That's a sort of, that is literally a kind of rank indicator that you have with the Volia Zakonye.
Wow. And do you know who the guy is with the gun? I thought you were going to say it's like...
I couldn't identify him. I searched. No, I don't know. I think it's something, you know, probably from the sort of, you know, either the late 70s or the 80s. I couldn't work out what the show was. But really interesting that they had this identification, which you'll see coming up in this song that is talked about next. This song by Arkady Seven, this sort of... prison song music that they record.
A singer called Arkady Sevenyi had secretly recorded what were called prison songs. Songs from the Vorvi Zakonye inside the jails that attacked not just the Soviets, but the whole Russian Empire.
Не надо грустить. Господа офицеры,
pause, please.
Что мы... Go on, Horace.
Just Simon, you mentioned that, like, those, I can't remember the Russian name for them, but that tier of prisoners, they have their roots back in 20s, 30s Gulag system. Right?
The Volia Zakonye, yeah.
Yeah. But I read the book Gulag by Anne Applebaum. I haven't read Solzhenitsyn's one, but she does discuss Solzhenitsyn's work quite a lot in the book anyway. He, her, and other writers all seem to agree that criminals rather than political prisoners had definitely the best sort of the best deal as prisoners, you know, like they would be able to lord it over all other prisoners, including to the point of being able to enslave other prisoners to some extent, like sex slaves and stuff. And like they still ruled as a criminal gang in the prison, and they got the best beds, and they got, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, like, I mean, we're talking about the 70s, 80s here, right? I was just wondering, I mean, the Gulag system itself kind of came to an end in, I don't know, the 50s, I think. The Gulag administration was abolished and changed into other stuff, but prison camps carried on, and the prison system carried on and continued to be pretty cruel. I was just wondering, were these guys by this time not in that sort of favourable position? Were they actually were they resenting that they'd been mixed in with the other?
No. I think this is the thing of why they became this tight-knit, highly organized fraternity, because they stuck rigidly to these codes that were enforced by violence, essentially, and that were very, very much rejectionist of everything about that system. But because obviously there was, you know, quite a number of them in these prisons, and they were prepared to kick off, you know, they were pretty much left alone.
The music. Right, so they go on, Horace. Sorry.
Even quite late in the day for the Soviet Union, these guys were still. They had a certain autonomy within their imprisonment. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite like, you know, being in an English prison, you know, where there'd be sort of concerns about welfare to some extent. I think it was probably pretty much, you know, when you were behind the door, you sorted yourselves out, and the hierarchy arranged itself, you know, I suppose, in the natural way, according to...
Also like in the Gulag.
Yeah. But these guys stood out and became the sort of evolution into the Russian mafia that went to America. Because again, they had these tightly organizing principles and these things that they absolutely stuck to about. I mean, again, they very much frame the idea of some kind of vanguard or some kind of elite within this highly unpleasant sphere.
I was just going to make a much more asinine comment, which is that the music sounds like Russian Leonard Cohen or perhaps even Russian Tom Waits.
Yeah, it's quite good. I've gone and listened to some of Arkady Seveny's stuff. Actually, I quite like it. It's almost like a sort of Russian blues in a way. Yeah. And this song is called Gaspada Officieri, Gentlemen Officers. That's how they see themselves.
I'm also going to do a multi-layered callback to many of the conversations we've had, Simon, right? Mm-hmm. Have a look at the frame now, right? Do you remember we talked about the Welsh comic Peter Bainham at one point? Mm-hmm. The guy on the left looks quite a lot like Peter Bainham. Right? Do you remember we talked a lot about my compost?
Yeah.
The guy in the front looks quite a lot like the beanie composter, the guy with his hot bin, right?
Yeah.
And the guy on the right, I don't know if it's just me. Let's squint your eyes a little bit.
Yeah.
Could be Richard Spencer.
Anyway. He looks like Ralph Ineson. You know Ralph Ineson, the actor?
He plays Finchy in The Office.
Yeah, Finchy. He does. Yeah, and he was right, in Chernobyl. Right. He does look like Finchy. You're right.
Yeah.
And he was like a Russian officer in Chernobyl as well. He was like a major or colonel or something. I had a question. I've forgotten what it was. Now, Peter Bainham, right? You know, if you looked on his CV, probably his biggest success in his career is that he co-wrote like Bruno or Borat, one of those movies, which was a big hit, right? So he's probably quite wealthy off of that. But he, but my favourite Peter Bainham term was always in, was it Fist of Fun when he was...
Yeah, he played the horrible, horrible guy living in his student flat or something, and really revolting kind of...
Weird obsessions and stuff. Yeah.
That's where I know him from Fist of Fun.
Yeah.
I think he had a hand in Partridge, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he's been a sort of Iannucci, Coogan, Chris Morris kind of writing and performing team. He's very good in the Chris Morris radio shows that he did on Radio 1 in the in about 1994. Chris Morris they'd be in the studio, and Chris Morris would send him out on ridiculous errands, like to go and steal a baby on Oxford Street or something like that.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who is more of a writer than a performer.
Yeah.
But he does turn up, like he does do the occasional turn type thing, doesn't he?
So. Yeah, he turns up all over the place.
Мы потеряли, уже не вернусь. Пусть нету отечества.
Sorry, I did have another question. I have just heard it said at some point by one or two different people that the so-called Russian mafia, as is in America, is in fact like largely of the tribe. Have you heard anything of that kind said of these guys? Was there like overrepresentation of...
It does come up in a bit. Curtis says what the Russians did was they deported them, they exiled them to America, and they told the Americans that they were Jews who they were putting into exile.
So if that was in the 70s or 80s, that would coincide with that, you know, let Russian Jews immigrate controversy that I don't really understand. But there was this, do you guys know about this? There was this campaign coming out of America and other, like Jews in America and stuff, like let Russian, like let Jews immigrate from the Soviet Union. I don't know why. Like, nobody was allowed to. It wasn't just Jews that weren't allowed.
I would say it's something to be, you know, taken under advisement. There's definitely a very strong Russian nationalist sentiment with these guys. The lyrics to this song, I'll just read a couple of little bits. Do not be sad, fellow officers. What we have lost, we cannot get back. Let there be no fatherland and no faith either, and our tough path is marked with blood. We are followed by countless steps. Thank you, my friends, that I'm not alone here. I too shall die in this struggle, as I am Russian, and I am Dvoryanin. Dvoryanin is a Russian term for nobleman. Let us be blown by mad winds. I mean, that to me is just ride the tiger, you know? Mm-hmm. No one will know where we laid our heads. And for the fatherland to be forever with us, leave us a handful of the Russian soil.
It's quite, I was going to say it's quite blood and soil, but I'm being a bit obvious by saying that.
It's possible they were just pretending to be Jewish as a means to get over.
Maybe. Who knows? I mean, I think they thought in terms of old Tsarist Russia.
And yeah, I mean, and like Russian nationalism is a disparate thing, right? I mean, it could be anything from like Pan-Slavism of the 1860s to civic nationalism of like Putin, you know, is a total civic.
Or Putin. We must start the story in 786 AD. Never forget.
Нет уж веры и кровью отмечен нелегкий наш путь. Пусть нету отечества.
I can't help but say, good on Putin for that. Give me a historical perspective any day over David Cameron bringing up, you know, gay marriage rights or whatever.
Do you remember the initial reaction to that was, God, it was so boring. Oh, you're boring. Do you remember? But nobody's forgot it, have they?
It's not boring. It's not boring. That's the most, when you can get politicians to admit their views on history, that's interesting. They usually would just say the blandest things, you know, but he was actually going into it. It's good.
Yeah, I actually think it makes sense of a lot of the things that Putin's trying to do. What Putin's trying to do is synthesize like the story of Russia into a kind of new nationalism now, which is what all nationalists do, really. A lot of nationalism is myth-making, right? And what Putin is trying to do is be like, right, you can't just say, and that's what partly what the rehabilitation of Stalin is about, because you can't just have this big black hole in the middle of Russian history for the past 80 years. We have to incorporate Soviet history as Russian history, and it belongs to that long timeline going all the way back, you know, to the Rus. That's what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Just be like, this is the history of my people, you know.
That term I mentioned, the Dvoryanin, these were guys who were members of the Tsar's retinue. They were nobility who were in service and became like hereditary, like the Roman thing, you know, they had the equestrian class, like a knight or a gentleman.
These criminals have named themselves after what used to be...
They see themselves in that lineage, yeah. And what AA is saying there is interesting, because there is this sort of element of what comes to be Soviet culture now becomes synthesized by the mix of kind of people like Limonov, who are the kind of what you'd call the nonconformists, the sort of, you know, the poetic, you know, the theater kids, the artsy set, and the very dark culture of the criminal underworld. And, you know, you see that in America, obviously expressed in hip hop. So, you know, there's a sort of kind of a natural sympathy in a way between the sort of two approaches to resisting the system.
So I just wonder, like, is America just where all the gangsters of the world go to fight it out? That's just the correct way to view it, you know? I don't know.
That is what we're watching right now. Gangsters fighting gangsters rolling around all over us.
Because Trump is behaving in a very gangster-like manner at the moment as well, it has to be said. And the Israelis is a very gangster state as well. Gangster nationalism.
But this is an interesting example of the... Sorry, go on, Horace.
It's either Joseph Jordan or Jose Nino, one of those two, has just said, and I've been thinking this for ages, just think of, I'm not going to use the phrase, but world that as a gang, as gangsterism before anything. It's not even about tribe
it's
or
mafia, yeah.
It's gangsterism.
It's mafia.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, not for you said it. Sorry, I can't remember.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know that he thinks that as well, but yeah, I just think that mafia explains a lot.
Yeah.
And not just them, of course. There's lots of different gangs, but it explains what's happening a lot. I mean, I think it's just becoming more and more naked in your face at the moment, you know. Anyway, let's carry on.
Нет уж веры, и кровью отмечен нелегкий наш путь.
Снимаешь, что ли, все? Ну что там? Интересно.
But then at the start of 1974, the Soviet leaders discovered what Solzhenitsyn had been writing. They debated whether to shoot him, but decided instead to expel him to the West. They also decided to take the opportunity to get rid of some of the other dissidents as well.
A lot of people are now defending the mafia's honor against what we've just said, that they conduct, actually the mafia conduct themselves a lot better than some of the
I must admit, I was thinking the same thing, that some of these guys seem a lot more principled than the gangsters we're talking about. They, in a way, I was reminded of your thing about Toynbee, about things going into a cultural retreat. Mm. You know, it's like fleeing to the hills to preserve the ancient songs. And in a way, these guys, they do have, I mean, this is something probably appeals to Curtis. There's a kind of, although we think of Soviet organized crime as, I mean, sorry, Russian organized crime as deeply brutal and dark, there's an element of them preserving this attachment to this world of tradition in which they were honorable soldiers. And this world of the Soviet Union, as I say, that comes out, that Putin is managing, has this sentiment underneath it of the ancient kind of literary jewelry of Russian civilization, as well as this very stark but tough and resilient side that also tries to kind of bring that stuff together and create a kind of inheritance that it has to take into the dark places in order to survive. And I think these guys are probably pretty, you know, pretty, as I say, pretty principled compared to the gangsters who believe in nothing, but who have all the money and all the Machiavellianism.
Mm. Yeah. So some people are talking about the British Empire there and trying to compare Trump's actions now to the British Empire. The thing is that, how can I say, like, the British Empire had some decent messaging when it tried to justify things, not only to the world, but to itself. And I feel like there's no real attempt to try to justify things at the moment, even to themselves. It's just like all out, yeah, this is just gangster. And I'm not sure if the British Empire ever just went all out, yeah, this is just gangster shit now. You know, they tended to wrap it up with, you know, higher ideals or talk of civilization or even like division of labor stuff or whatever it is.
They were making functional improvements, going out to India and laying down a railway system, you know, whereas Talk TV this morning is we should just go into Iran and smash it because they're not nice and they should be nice like us.
You know, that guy from the Young Turks went on that show, right? And Bastani is talking about this now, right? He said, like, look, this Iranian fascist, they're calling her, I mean, she's a Zio shill, right, has basically gone on there and said, like, look, we need to go in there, you know, if you're a part of the regime, you know, there's that English professor who goes on all the shows, right? They're basically saying, like, yeah, when we take over, you're going to be killed, mate, you know, we're just going to round you all up and kill you, type thing. And what Bassani's saying is, like, this is not going to get people. Like, how are you going to take over a country if you're going in with this, oh, yeah, we're just going to kill anybody associated with the regime? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people.
And
you know what I mean? It's just,
and we end up with Iraq again. We wipe out the bureaucratic administrative class, the Baathists, and the country falls into anarchy.
If they fuck it up as badly as they fucked up Iraq, it's a much bigger, like, Iran is like five times bigger or something. It's like, it's a proper big country, right? It's like, and it obviously bought 10
it's like trying to invade Germany or something like that. Yeah.
right, it's like, Iran's like not a, it's not a joke. It's like America could seriously destroy itself. I kind of hope, it sounds mental, but I kind of hope that they stumble into what they appear to be threatening, and that it's just the last, it is the last thing. They can't.
2 years left.
There's no way.
2 years left. That's all I'm saying.
Two years.
It is written.
You've arrived at 2028 as well. For what exactly?
It is written. That's 80 years. The curse of the eighth decade, 80 years. That's it. That's all you get. I don't make the rules. You have to argue with the big man.
I think the big financial panic comes in 2028. So that would make sense. That slots into place. Okay.
And I think the 250 years is coming up on America. That's the glub cycle. That's coming up soon, isn't it? Glub says you get 250 years. You know, it is where it is. Every empire gets 250 years.
Yeah. So this year is going to be the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, I don't know exactly when you start the measurement, but in theory, the glub cycle is up as well. There's a lot of prophecies to fulfill. Anyway, let's see what happens. We're truly entering the age of crisis as foretold by the fourth turning.
Did you ever read Hobsbawm books, Eric Hobsbawm, the commie?
No, I didn't know.
He had a series of four sort of world history, modern histories of the world. Lots and lots of stats. It's not brilliant, but it's fairly interesting. And the last one was about the 20th century, and that was called Age of Extremes. And of course, looking back, the 20th century does seem pretty extreme compared to most time. The amount of killing and so on, and just the scale of things and the rapidity of things. But I just see this century so far. We're already a quarter of the way into it now. It's just one of like confusion and unclearness and bizarreness, you know? I don't know what I'm talking about, but that's my summary of this century so far. It's weird. Weird and fuzzy.
Edward Limonov and Yelena were summoned to KGB headquarters and told that they were being sent to New York. While many of the leading criminals, the Vorvi Zakonye, were taken from the prisons and put on planes to New York as well, the Soviets told the Americans that they were another group of Jews who were being allowed to emigrate.
Pause, please. Sorry, since we're likening things to Scarface, that's like Scarface as well, right? So there was some discharge of people, and just along with that, other criminals. There you go. Right.
Yeah. In Scarface, the Mariel boat lift, and Castro says he's flushing the toilets of Cuba onto America.
And obviously every country that's got like an asylum seeker policy, and a policy that accepts asylum seeking refugees. Obviously, that's just a drain. That's like someone else's toilet drain into our mouths, basically.
Mm. I was just also reflecting on the fact that, you know, Curtis's recent series is called Shifty. I think his next series is going to be called what you said. It's going to be called Weird and Fuzzy. That's going to be his next one.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
I've got a feeling that title would upset Dawn Butler or somebody like this, you know. Or what's her name? Diane Mathematics Abbott. She'd say, fuzzy is a connotations of this kind of hateful history of racial animus. I don't think this word should be used.
But you can't hit me. Why don't you try? You're gonna miss, you sure?
Most of the Russian criminals set up home in Brighton Beach, just outside New York.
Just a word of warning, fellas. I'm going to have to wrap up in 10 minutes because I agreed to go on Lotus Eaters today to talk about Star Wars. So give us 10 minutes, all right?
They created their own organization called the Potato Bag Gang. It was the start of the modern Russian mafia in America. Limonov and Yelena were helped by Russian emigre writers and artists already in Manhattan. And they soon became a glamorous couple, invited to parties by rich Americans who wanted to meet Soviet dissidents.
Pause, please.
But the new...
Sorry, I know nobody can probably answer this immediately, but just you just hear Russian emigre circles. Like, we're in the 70s or 80s now. It's 60 years at least since the revolution, right? Nobody's allowed to immigrate from communist Russia, communist Soviet Union. So when we say immigrates, again, it just means those who've been given special license to leave. Like, the same... That controversy that I referred to before, this thing of, like, for some reason, there was just this lobby for letting Jews out of the Soviet Union while everyone else remained trapped inside. I think that's what was immigrants. How come?
I just want to comment on the fact that this man that we're watching here is incapable of having any photo that doesn't look like it should be the front cover of an album.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Every single shot of him is picture perfect. How is it possible?
It's got that great Bodie from The Professionals kind of couture there. White disco suit, dark shirt.
Do we know what street is behind him?
Oh, don't know. Don't know. The Potato Bag Gang, by the way, is an interesting story that they talk about. Do you guys remember when in London you used to get on Oxford Street, there was this place that would do these Dutch auctions where people would be conned into buying garbage bags full of junk? You know, they would go to these auctions and they'd be sort of taken into, like, you'd usually be like an empty shop and a bunch of basically criminals would be claiming to sell these mystery bags, you know, full of goodies, you know, like high-end cameras and watches and stuff like that. And people would do these kind of anonymized, well, they'd bid on things without knowing what was in the bags, essentially. But they'd be promised, you know, there'd be a setup where one of the gang would go in and bid on one of the bags and he would open it and it would turn out to be some high-end piece of electronics and, you know, he'd pretend to be a satisfied customer. So other people would start throwing money at the auction and then they would discover the garbage bags they were given were full of just, you know, just junk or just cheap products. And that's what the Potato Bag Gang did. They claimed to, they found other Soviets who'd got out, and they were the ones that they approached actually tended to be the Jewish refugees who'd got out. And the gang, who were generally from Ukraine, they would offer them bags, like, you know, these anonymized bags, you know, and they would say, well, these are gold rubles in these bags. And they would show them like genuine rubles and say, you know, like this, you know, these are gold coins from the Tsarist period. And so that, you know, the people would see a few genuine coins and they would think, oh, well, they must be filled with rubles. And the most of the bag was just filled with potatoes. So they would sell these guys bags of potatoes.
I remember just any time I used to go to Oxford Street, there was signs up saying, yeah, auction that way and golf sale. But I never went to either.
Yeah, just a con job.
Just to quash rumours in the chat, Harry from the Lotus Eaters has developed an interest that is one of my very special interests. And that interest is defending the honour of the Star Wars prequel films from decades of attack from Mr. Plinkett and Red Letter Media. I mean, I believe that the prequel Star Wars films will be remembered and are modern day masterpieces of political filmmaking. And
I didn't mean to talk over you. This bit of a delay. Yeah. I've never seen this Plinkett review, and I still think they're cack. Like, they're really bad films. Like, I've seen worse.
I disagree. I think they are, in many ways, the kind of war and peace of our time. You know, there's this just, yeah, I mean, I'll save it for when I talk to Harry, but I really,
sure.
I mean, even Attack of the Clones, I'll defend.
So. I thought the plots were quite good, but the acting and dialogue and stuff was awful, awful.
Let's stop here because we'll remember the shot. Simon, 43 minutes.
This is the first episode we're going to get five separate streams out of.
Yeah.
If we go and
too much
it.
Talking, that's our problem.
That's it.
I do love Watto, though.
Watto. I mean, yeah, Watto's a great character.
I love that.
But, I mean, there's a whole, like, I'll save it for the thing, but if you've watched any of my stuff on Star Wars in the past, there's a whole thing that you're not appreciating about the world building in those films. You know, notice the Watto is dealing in hard currency, Horace, because the credit system of the Rotten Republic is already worthless. That's why he doesn't accept credits.
What does he want?
Hard gold, hard money.
Yeah. Would Palpatine have taken the Republic off the gold standard?
Qui-Gon Jinn just tries to get past his good sense, doesn't he? He just tries to wave him into thinking that credits will be fine. These shit ever inflating currency. Yeah.
But think about the Jedi Order defending a rotten, corrupt, bureaucratic regime that didn't deserve saving. Okay, the heroic great man of history, Palpatine, comes, washes away the trash. The Jedi
the plot was interesting, but why did they just use such poor actors and those poor, like, really cheesy scripts and stuff? Like, what?
I think it's a mortal dialogue. It's a mortal dialogue.
Having said that, I watched the original trilogy a few months ago, and I really enjoyed them, but the acting's not very good. Like, obviously, none of those are good actors, are they? Like, Hamill, Fisher, and Force.
Burmeister as Palpatine is one of the all-time great performances.
He's quite a good actor, yeah. And James Earl Jones is a good actor.
And there's tons of Palpatine in those movies. Anyway, I don't want to waste all my defensive talking points before I get on there.
But, Watto is great.
Credits are not good here.
There are a couple of super chats. Port Film Co-op says, accent challenge for Simon. French film critic talking about how early Adam Curtis is better than the Je n'arrive pas à te sourire de ma tête.
No.
He also says, keep your eye on Australia. Huge anti-Semitism legislation is coming in. Huge censorship coming in. Most of the far right is disbanded overnight. It's worth looking into. I did see that. There's only two things I'll say about that. One is that if ever an event needs looking at twice, it is that Bondi Beach thing that happened.
Bondi Beach.
Yeah, that needs to be looked at again, I would suggest. And, the other thing is, I remember years ago, I told people to keep away from some of the individuals involved in that. And lo and behold, look what's happened. So there we are.
Simon, do you like Watto, and can you do a line of Watto dialogue?
I can't, actually. I'm not well-versed in the prequels. I will have to go and... When I saw them, I rejected them because I'm Gen X and we are trapped in our original trilogy mindset. But I will go back and fairly reappraise these films, and I will be guided by the interesting thoughts from this channel.
AJ says, has any of the panel seen the works of Geoffrey Jones, known for his films made for BR and Shell? His editing style reminds me of Adam Curtis. I wonder if it had an influence on him, particularly All Watched Over by Machines and Love and Grace.
Don't know those. Don't know that particular filmmaker. But it's interesting. You're saying it's interesting that he was making films for, I assume, BR British Rail and Shell the Oil Company. A part of the research for this episode, I was looking at films that were made by the Coal Board. It was interesting back in the days where, in the 60s, 50s, 60s and 70s, you had film units attached to these big companies or state industries that would do the kind of PR in that way. And the films are very redolent of a style of people like Humphrey Jennings, who was a well-known British documentarian of the post-war period, who did a lot of the recording the sort of rebuilding of Britain and the society of the time. They're quite cozy films to watch, like a lot of the BBC archive. And as I've mentioned previously, famously, Humphrey Jennings' cameraman was Adam Curtis's father. So I think Curtis picked up a lot from Jennings's style as well. And he obviously has used clips that are very similar of that kind of genre of work of guys who were in these kind of government or company film units. It's unimaginable now that you think there'd be kind of dedicated film units sort of doing stuff. I mean, obviously there's internal PR for certain companies, but most often they probably outsource it these days.
All right, so I think that's it for the super. Oh, there's one more super chat. Dave Harris says, was Horace at the election party night in London? Were you at a party in London? Yeah, were you at election night party in London?
No, when was election night? Last year?
Horace went to a party celebrating Keir Starmer coming in. I don't think so. Mm. Doesn't sound like the Horace I know.
Mm. I've never been to an election night party. No, I haven't.
Or were you celebrating zero seats, perhaps?
Mm.
I went to a zero seats party.
I was still pissed off at how many seats the Tories got, but we did well.
We still don't forget. In my assessment, we didn't kill the Tories enough. Unfortunately.
No.
And T-1000 is stirring. Have you noticed? Affections to reform that Iraqi bloke is back.
This is a question I was just discussing with my friend Hector Drummond in the last few days as to, you know, whether this is out of the people that they've taken into reform. I mean, if they do it once more, I mean, it feels like they're already kind of weakening now through taking in these ex-Tories, but it feels like if they took in another one of a similar profile to Nadeem Zahawi,
they're going to create a fracture. What are you going to do, Simon?
Vote Labour?
Yeah, they're gonna
keep doing it, and they'll say that.
That's the problem. That's the whole trap over and over and over again.
Boris, exactly. They'll bring Boris in. If they think they can handle him, they'll bring Boris in.
I'm gonna cut up my membership card and watch a Maya Tusi stream. That's what I'm gonna do.
I might vote for Sultana.
Just fight the system.
Ultimate FU against everybody. Come on, Sultana, me and you.
She's married.
That's been disappointing too. Corbyn is fucking weak as well. If I was on that side of things, you know, pro Palestine, I'd feel like Corbyn is just a regime shill. You know, the shit he comes out with. He makes too many concessions. That statement he made about the Iranian government and so on. Come on, you're not a comrade. It's not good enough.
This is partly how he was forced out of the leadership. He didn't defend himself with intelligence and vigor. It's really weak.
Galloway gets it. Corbyn. Anyway.
Get Galloway on your channel. Have Galloway on as guest.
Yeah, I don't. Well, I don't mean it's easier said than done. Galloway is an international superstar. So,
okay.
You know. But anyway, thank you very much, chaps. I will get myself ready. I don't know if it's going to air now, but at least I'm going to go and record it now. But yeah, look out for me on Star Wars on Lotus Eaters soon. Bye, everyone.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.